Dedication to all dogs of dogs, dedicated to all top dogs, liberty crew. Man called Tony Kelly, the man called Robert, and while Apache riding through. Curfew! Sometimes a back of some of them a rally back. We a road boy, you tell we no take back no chat. Sometimes a back of some of them a rally back. But we a road boy, you tell we no take back no chat. You full of big chat and can't defend that. If a jailhouse you come from, we sending you go back. You full of big chat and can't defend that. If a Bellevue you come from, we sending you go back. Cause with them there when they get a run out. When we look in the food for the pot. Man of him 16 over him back. 45 and we have a rampart.
Welcome to another episode of the Let's Be Forget podcast, the historical podcast by Tenement Yard Media. Yes, obviously this is not Davey. My name is Dominic Stewart, or Cooly Dopey on Twitter, and I am the special guest for this week's podcast. And this week, we'll be talking about a very special topic to me and something that I've been researching for the last 2 years. Specifically the Indo-Jamaican heritage, and what we're going to be looking at today is under the topic Coolie Gang, Ghettos and Rastafari, a story of four continents and a couple black markets. And so it's an intersection of all the things that I'm really fascinated about in my research. And so the song that we actually started off today with was Ghetto Red Hot by Supercat. And it might sound strange, why would we start off as an episode about coolies and then we start off with Ghetto Red Hot by Supercat? Supercat was born William Anthony Mirage in Kingston in 1963. I chose this song for two reasons. One, Supercat is Indo-Jamaican, Mirage. And two, he's talking about the ghettos. But that last name, Mirage, is really special and very important to me. It's actually the family that I'm from as an Indo-Jamaican. My mother's last name is Mirage. But also the founder of Rastafari, he took on this last name, Mirage. And that's actually how I got into this research about Rastafari and its relationship to the Indians and Indo-Jamaicans, because of that last name, Mirage. And we'll get more into that specifically. But also another important point, an interesting point for me in terms of my own genealogy and family history, Leonard Howell was close to an Indian bodyguard of his called Lalu. And I have an uncle whose name is also Mirage, and his last name is Lalu, different from the actual Lalu that was around during Leonard Howell, obviously. But that intersection really led me to the kind of research that I'm trying to do right now. And so we're going to actually start off this conversation in India, not in Jamaica. And so one of the easiest things to forget is actually that India was part of the British Empire. After the 1857 Sipai Mutiny, or the Indian Rebellion of 1857, India officially becomes part of the British Empire. And so we know, for example, from Radhika Mahase's work, that the British colonial rule in India led to this intensification of poverty. And so when we know that when famine hit very specific regions, we know that there was a significant increase of those from those regions who were looking for registration for indenture. But even before we get into indentureship, let's start thinking about the Indian presence in Jamaica before the arrival of Indians. So even before the arrival of so-called Indian coolies, religious intimacies did exist between Afro-Jamaicans and Indians in the anxieties of the colonial and ecclesiastical administrations. You know, the churches were arguing that indenture was a new form of slavery, yet they didn't necessarily oppose the idea of indentureship when it was European indentureship or when it was African indentureship or anything like that. It seemed that the major part of the concern was the religious life of the Indians, specifically the Hindus. And so, for example, we have a statement from the Baptist Union of Jamaica, and it's sometimes attributed to William Knibb, and it says, "The immigration of a number of heathen and pagan foreigners with their religious superstitions, idolatry, and wickedness will act most injuriously on the morals of the black inhabitants and hinder very much the efforts that are now in operation for their moral and religious improvement." And so from this statement, we get a clear understanding that there is a kind of intimacy or an antagonism in the colonial mind between the Christianized population and the potential of importing Indians. And so, for example, we know that a couple months after Indians finally come to Jamaica in December of 1845, we have Reverend Walter Dedney, who is the head of the Western Baptist Union, declares that as Christian ministers, we cannot but view with dismay a measure which is sure to produce the same disgusting vice that has degraded Demerara and the Mauritius and so calculated to impede the progress of morals and religion in the island and to destroy many of the benefits conferred upon the agricultural laborers by the glorious act of emancipation. And so even before the arrival of Hindus, and Hindus specifically, there was this overarching fear of what is going to happen to the spiritual economy of Jamaica. With all these so-called pagans and all these Hindus, what are they going to do to this Christianized population? And going beyond that, the Indian presence was also felt in Jamaica in other ways. And we know that Indianship starts in Jamaica in 1845, but curiously in 1844, in the national population census, there was an East Indian. And I've always been curious, who the hell was this person? I don't know to this day, and it's still a question that I'm trying to figure out. Professor Vereen Shepherd has actually speculated, saying it's probably one of the Indian indenturers who was in Guyana who got released prematurely or something like that. But she herself concludes that she doesn't necessarily know. And there's possibilities as well that Indians had existed in the 1830s in Jamaica. We don't know. Recent research as well talks about Asian Indians in Saint-Domingue, which is modern-day Haiti. And like many of the Afro-Haitians who came to Jamaica, the Indian that I mentioned earlier was found in St. Thomas in the East. And so the question is, did the earliest presence of Indians in Jamaica, was that because of the sort of geographical relationship between Haiti and Jamaica? I don't know. And maybe it's something that we'll never know. But there was definitely some idea or some presence of the Indian before the Indian actually came to Jamaica. Now, as slavery drew to an end in the British West Indies in the 1830s, the colonial administration already began experimenting with other forms of controllable labor in their colonies. And so this is the rise of indentureship. There was this so-called labor problem that plantation owners were complaining about. They were saying that there's a shortage of labor. We need people to work the plantation, but there wasn't enough people. And this by itself was already a lie, because we know that there was enough people, like the Afro-Jamaicans, enough Afro-Jamaicans were in Jamaica to actually work the plantation. So it wasn't a labor problem per se. And so many of the formerly enslaved actually refused to work on the plantations because it presented little change from the days of slavery. The anti-slavery reporter noted that the Afro-Jamaican population was more than sufficient to meet all the demands of the sugar estates for labor on the condition that they could receive fair wages, being promptly paid and getting decently civil treatment. And so because of those sort of factors that were pushing them off the plantation, but also pulling them elsewhere, the colonial administration decided to turn to a different form of controllable workforce in this sort of paternalistic contracted labor system known as indentureship. And so that really is the birth of the indentureship in Jamaica specifically, but in the wider region. And so we know that they experimented with Europeans, and they also experimented with formerly enslaved from other Caribbean islands, from Africa, India, and China. But the overwhelming majority of those who were indentured in Jamaica were Indian coolies, approximately 37,000 of them. And so in 1845, indentureship begins in Jamaica. To be an indenture, you'd have to sign a contract. But we have to remember as well, it's not like a contract where these Indians would necessarily understand them or they were able to read them. You know, they were in English, of course. Indians couldn't, most of them couldn't even read their native languages. Their signature was just a thumbprint, and you get loaded on a ship. And this by itself was really interesting, because the way in which recruitment happened wasn't necessarily the most ethical all the times. And so we know stories of women and girls being kidnapped in order to meet the gender ratio that was required. We know that some Indians actually thought that Jamaica was somewhere in India. We know that some of them were young and they were promised these great returns on crossing the Kalapani. And it wasn't necessarily the most ethical It's definitely not ethical the way in which a lot of the indenturers were recruited. And the contracts themselves, the fact that they couldn't read them, but also the fact that they were contracts and they had criminal sanctions to them, and there were much harsh labor laws that existed within the colonies and all of that. But in the case of Jamaica, throughout indentureship, the Clarendon and Westmoreland estates took the most indenturers, and other significant concentrations of coolies were in St. Mary, Portland, and St. Thomas. And besides being settlement for Indian indenturers, both Clarendon and St. Thomas are important parishes in the development of Rastafari. And so the concern here is going to be especially about the religion. So what was the religiosity, what was the religious landscape of indenturers? Approximately 90% of the Jamaican Indian indentures were Hindus. The remaining 10% were Muslims and about a dozen Christians. On arrival, the colonial administration didn't necessarily group them based on their caste, language, or religion. And so this sort of disregard of their own identities created new alliances, but it forcefully exposed Indians in a way that allowed for intraculturation. And that specifically just looks at the ways in which Indian cultures were just exposed to each other to create this kind of new Indian culture or new identity. On the plantations as well, there was initial exchange between Afro-Jamaicans and the Indian indenturers. A lot of labor-efficient lexicons were exchanged in order to make work more efficient. There was also a lot of spiritual exchanges that we'll encounter later, but also a lot of culinary exchanges as well that were very important on these plantations. And so Hinduism on the plantations were varied. At no point was there really a kind of a uniform strategy that was everywhere on every single plantation, but there were definitely things that I can highlight that sort of paints a picture of what the Hinduism looked like in Jamaica during the period of indentureship. And so in the evenings during indentureship, priests were reciting the Hindu epics, the mystical poetry. They not only read them, they were performing them in public view. They were reading scriptures like the Ramayana, the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavatam Puran. They were celebrating religious festivals as well, which the Afro-Jamaicans actively took part in. You know, for example, you have the Hosse celebration, and you have stories of Afro-Jamaicans actually helping to build the elaborate tazias. You also had a kind of bringing of the Hindu spirituality into the home in a very specific way. And so their walls were decorated with mantras. They were decorated with yantric symbols. Houses were arranged by special Puranic cosmologies. And so there was all of that, but a very specific kind of worship that I want to get into is the Kali Puja. And I'll talk a bit more about that, but the Kali Puja is probably the most important, in my opinion, Hindu practice that survives even to this day, but not necessarily called the Kali Puja in the overall landscape of Jamaica. And so even though a puja is just a worship, a kind of worship, and the Hindus perform pujas all around. They performed it in structures that they created, like Vedis or their homes, or they performed it in streams near their barracks or wherever the case may be. Now, the Kali Puja is a very specific kind of puja. It was dedicated to the goddess Kali. In it, a goat was sacrificed, and its blood was drained on a Kali Murti, if there was a Kali Murti. And the meat was prepared into curry goat. And after that whole ritualistic preparation, there was also the smoking of ganja as part of the religious practice, but also the preparation of bang, which is a kind of drink made from ganja. And so caste is also something to consider when we think about Hinduism in Jamaica. Now, boarding the ship and crossing the Kalapani by itself was an act that was breaking caste obligations. And Brahmins weren't necessarily supposed to do that, but a lot of Brahmins were actually in Jamaica. The plantation owners actually requested that Brahmins don't be a part of, or they should be excluded from their quotas, but many had eventually slipped through many of the checks that sought to bar them. If we don't know what Brahmins are, they are at the top of the Hindu caste system, and they were these priests, spiritual advisors, and religious academics, you know, positions that are conferred to them by birth. So you're born into a caste. And many of the Brahmins who served on the plantations had the last name Maharaj. And that's, again, is a very important last name. I mentioned earlier my own last name, but also Supercat's last name. And so it was also the last name that Leonard Howell, the most influential founder of early Rastafari, actually adopted. And we'll get more into that a bit later. Some Brahmins came to Jamaica after being promised work as priests, such as Danuk Maharaj. And then you have other Brahmins who, when they came to when they came to Jamaica, and they were told of the sort of work that they had to do, and that was not supposed to be done by them as being part of the Brahmin caste, they would necessarily protest that labor. And so, for example, you have the story of Ganga Maharaj, who actually mutilated his own fingers in front of the magistrate to protest manual labors. And there was also a subgroup of Brahmins known as the Sadhus, and they were in Jamaica. We have many stories of Sadhus. Well, not many. We have a couple stories of Sadhus in Jamaica that positioned them before and after Rastafari. They had several non-conforming practices of detachment in order to lead an absolute religious life. They would smear their bodies in ashes. They generally practice things that are not necessarily approved of by society. They practice strict, very strict versions of vegetarianism. They had matted hair. They smoked ganja. And by the way, you can still find sadhus in India today. It's not something that died out. Sadhus still exist in India today. Now, we know that a sadhu, the last record that I found of a sadhu actually existing in West Kingston was in 1968. And this helps to position them at a time of Rastafari in infancy. We have records of sadhus before the coronation of His Imperial Majesty in 1930. And we have records of sadhus existing in Jamaica in 1968. That kind of chunk of time helps to position the sadhus existing at the same time as Rastafari infancy, which we'll get to more of that later. Now, how exactly did the Indians interact with Afro-Jamaicans? And we have to remember that when the Indians came here, they didn't come here in a bubble. They didn't exist by themselves. They were pushed into a population of Afro-Jamaicans. And so before 1930, the Indian and Black relationship seemed to be emphasized in statements by Black Jamaicans like, "Make them come now, massa. They will buy our ground provisions from we." And so even before the arrival of Indo-Jamaicans, it seems that the Afro-Jamaican population was welcoming them because of economic reasons. You have reports in the Morning Journal, for example, that say the immigrants have been well treated by the Black peasantry in the country, who have promised to do all in their power for the strangers who have come to a strange land. When they came, they occupied the same social class as Indian, as Afro-Jamaicans. They worked on the same plantations that I'd mentioned earlier. And some Afro-Jamaicans participated in much of their religious life. Indian and Afro-Jamaicans had children together and interracial relationships. There's also the remnants of that sort of relationship of the spiritual encounters, even to this day, because you can go to some Indo-Jamaicans who will talk about the pujas, and they still perform their pujas, but they'll warn something like, "You got to be careful. If you do the puja wrong, it will turn back on you." And we know that that statement in and of itself is a kind of cross-cultural borrowing, because we know that turn back panyo is really an Afro-Jamaican spiritual practice, especially when we think about something like obia. If you don't do the obia properly, it will turn back panyo. And so, as I mentioned earlier, approximately 37,000 Indians came to Jamaica. Two-thirds of those Indians actually stayed in Jamaica for several reasons, But we also have to remember as well that these numbers don't take into account the number of children that were born while in Jamaica. They also don't take into account the children born from interracial relationships and all of that. And from 1880 to 1930, we know that there's an increase in the rate of settlement of the formerly indentured Indians in Jamaica. And that that's for several reasons. But what's important to note here is that they didn't create exclusive Indian settlements like in Trinidad and Guyana. You know, they couldn't do that, one, because of their numbers, two, because of how they were dispersed in Jamaica, but also there's also on the micro scale, we don't know what the relationship was like, but we can properly say that the relationship was more amicable than what possibly was in Trinidad or Guyana or anything like that. However, where there were significant concentrations of Indians in Jamaica, those towns were labeled as Coolie towns or Hindu towns. Currigoat also, during this time, 1880 to 1930, began being welcomed into the everyday Jamaican diet. And we know that Afro-Jamaican provisions also started being incorporated into Indo-Jamaican dishes or Indian dishes, I guess, at that time. Now, the first half of the 20th century also saw the migration of many of these Indo-Jamaicans from rural to urban Jamaica. They settled in urban Jamaica. They mostly settled in areas along Spanish Town Road. And if you know where Spanish Town Road is, it's like that stretch from Tivoli, go all the way to... It's that stretch from Tivoli, go all the way to Riverton. Like, all of that right there is Spanish Town Road. And so they settled mostly along the slums that existed along Spanish Town Roads. And in these settlements, we know that the Indo-Jamaican population, they were speaking Hindi. And even some Afro-Jamaicans were also able to speak Hindi, memorizing religious poetry and things like that. Okay, so all of that was just background information to get us all up to speed. All right, I know that was a lot, and that's a lot to take in. So I just want us to breathe it in, smoke it in, because all that was just background information. And this is where my research really starts. So I recently had a paper published called Early Encounters in Colonial Jamaica, Hindu and Rastafari Divine Metaphysics. And so this is what I'm going to be saying right now, is most of it is going to be the research that I've done and had it published. And so this is the exciting part for me. But previously, what I just said, that's just background information that I want us to get to bring us up to speed to talk about this specifically. And so we reach 1930 now, and so Rastafari starts. By 1930, almost a century had passed since the emancipation in Jamaica, and yet there was little to no mobility in Jamaica's class structure. Afro-Jamaicans and also Indo-Jamaicans were occupying the lowest class structures. Also, we have to remember as well that Jamaica was still a colony at this time, or part of the empire. They were upset with this worship of a white Christ, you know, a British king. And Rastafari itself emerges within this context of frustration. It's compounded with other things as well, but this context of frustration is really important in understanding the emergence of Rastafari. Now, in 1930, Rastafari was crowned Emperor Haile Selassie I of Ethiopia. Rastafari, as a movement, starts as a reaction to this event. Now, that is very key, very important. Nothing else we need to consider. We don't need to think about anything else right now. Right now, what we need to think about is that Rastafari as a movement starts as a reaction to the event of the crowning of His Imperial Majesty. Now, Rastafari, what exactly is it? I think about it in a way that I think Rastafari, now what exactly is it? Now, I think about it like this. Rastafari is a spiritual turn against the white world. And from that, we can derive the basic tenets of Rastafari. And I say tenets with quotations around them, because Rastafari doesn't necessarily have codified tenets in that way. But there are definitely genealogies of ideas that we can recognize and say that this is Rastafari. And so when I say a spiritual turn against the white world, that comes up with two main things. The white world creates this ethic of Babylon-Zion dichotomy, where we have the cyclical Babylon, and the current production of that cyclical Babylon is the white world colonialism and capitalism. And then on the other hand, we think about Selassie as an articulation of this path out of the white world. And so from that, we derive two other things as well that's very important to understand Rastafari. So Selassie as an articulation of the path out of this world, we have the concept of I and I, which is the bulk of my research. And then there's this concept of liberty. And I won't even talk about the Hindu influences on liberty. As I mentioned earlier, you had the resonances between the dreadlocks, the vegetarian diet, and all of that, but also even the ideas of menstruating women. You had the Jutta practice. I remember my grandmother, we couldn't eat food before it's actually done, because my grandma would warn us, you eat Jutta the pot. That sort of Hindu practice, you see a lot of these resonating in the kind of liberty of Rastafarian. I mean, there's a lot of debate over, okay, where exactly this comes from and all of that. And I won't even get into all of those, but that's one aspect of that ethic as Selassie as an articulation of the path, the liberty. But what I'm going to be focusing on is this concept of I and I. But even before I get there, there's always this question about Marcus Garvey. What the hell was his relationship to the movement? And much has been written about it. Initially, Garvey's reaction to the crowning of His Imperial Majesty was very amicable. It was very welcoming. However, by 1935, we know that Garvey's criticism of the emperor was great, especially for how he handled the Second Italo-Ethiopian War. And by 1936, we know that Garvey was calling Selassie a coward because Selassie decided to go in exile in Britain. And so Garvey's critique really ramped up around this time of the emperor. Garvey also pulled his support for the emperor, citing that the monarch had sold out to the white people. We also have to think about what was Garvey's relationship to the actual manifestation of the movement in Jamaica, the Rastafari movement. We have to remember, when we think about that, we have to remember that Garvey was unapologetically Christian. You know, Chavans actually says that whatever Marcus Garvey thought about the emperor, and he later was to think ill of him for fleeing the Italian invasion to lead the resistance from exile rather than from within, he did not think of him in any way, shape, or form as divine, let alone as Jesus Christ or the returned Messiah. And so we have to remember this when we think about Garvey's relationship to the movement. And I mean, there are other things as well that are important to say as well, but I feel like so many people have said them already, I don't necessarily need to reiterate them right now. No, Garvey was not a fan of a lot of the religious groups in Jamaica. For one, we know that he wasn't a fan of revivalism at all. Dr. Clinton Hutton, for example, notes that Garvey condemned this movement in racist language, similar to that which was used by the colonial state and church. Garvey also wouldn't give Howell the kind of platform that Howell needed for the early Rastafari movement. And so we have right here a rift developed after Garvey reputedly called Howell's Rastafari movement a clan, which means a cult. And the first time the gong, or Leonard Howell, got locked up in Jamaica, rumor has it that it was a result of the Garveyites. Now, we know that's a sort of illegitimate or illegal historical source, but it's still something that's worth mentioning right here. I don't know what exactly Garvey thought. I couldn't crystallize word for word what exactly Garvey thought about the Rastafari movement, but I don't think it was necessarily something that was good about the movement. I don't think he thought about the movement in the way that much Jamaicans picture his relationship, and not just Jamaicans, the world at large, how they picture his relationship to the Rastafari movement. You know, there are stories, oral histories that talk about when Rastas went to his meetings, he would put them over one side, he would segregate them. As I said earlier, he didn't want to give Leonard Howell any kind of platform to talk about Rastafari as divine. And so I don't know anything, but you know what? When you see Marcus Garvey, you can ask him yourself, when do you think about Rastafari? For now, I don't have that information, but it doesn't look like he necessarily had a pretty relationship with the movement, both his understanding of Rastafari or Haile Selassie, and the movement of Rastafari. No, what exactly was early Rastafari like? No, the founding of Rastafari is usually attributed to four figures. I mentioned Howell earlier. So you have Howell, Hines, well, I should probably call out their full names. Leonard Howell, Robert Hines, Joseph Nathaniel Hibbert, and Archibald Dunkley. Now, most scholars would say that Leonard Howell was the most successful of these early leaders. But Barry Chevans will actually say that it was Hines who was the most influential out of all of these. But everybody else seemed to agree that Leonard Howell was the most influential out of these. Now, it's purported that all four started working independently of each other. They collaborated every now and then, but we understand that they started preaching about the divinity of His Imperial Majesty independently. That's what the claim is. Now, all four men were black, except Hines, who was also part East Indian. And now, before I even continue, I want to make a note about blackness right here. Most of us, when we think about blackness, we think about blackness as in our racial calculations as a kind of dirtying agent. If somebody has a black parent, they're black. And we know that this is a holdover from slavery and slave society and all of that. And so, this sort of way of thinking about blackness has sort of seeped into the way in which literature on early Rastafari is being done, where we don't take seriously this sort of Indianness of Hines. But that's just a kind of note that I want us to hold as I continue this discussion. But it's very important that we also recognize that this sort of East Indian ancestry that Hines also claims. Now, my main focus now is going to be on Leonard Howell. As I said, that he was the most influential of the early Rastafari leaders. Now, Howell was born in Clarendon in 1898, at a time when East Indians lived in parts of the parishes. He traveled around, and his last residence before his 1932 deportation to Jamaica was Harlem. And we know in Harlem he was running this so-called tea room, where he was carrying out healing practices. And he's been accused by different fellows, saying that he was a Obeah man in this tea room and all of that. Helen Lee actually talks about the kind of drinks that he created in this tea room are probably the same kind of ganja drinks that he was creating at Pinnacle, the first Rastafari commune. But we know that Leonard Howell wasn't necessarily a fan of this Obeah conversation because, in the Promise Key, he sort of denounces a lot of African continuities and this sort of Obeah claim. Now, Leonard Howell begins preaching about Selassie in Kingston upon his return in 1932. Now, he actually relocates his effort to St. Thomas because he didn't really gain much of a following in Kingston. And throughout his time in the 1930s, his spiritual career and religious career in the 1930s, we know that he moved back and forth between these two locations in St. Thomas and Kingston. And he was conducting street meetings at the time with Hines. And so that's one of the places that we know that collaboration did happen between Hines and Howell with those street meetings until 1940. Often left out of the scholarship about Howell's followers was that it had a significant number. We don't know this exact number. We know though that there was a significant number of practicing Hindus within this sort of population. Another important idea as well is that within Kingston, where Leonard Howell was going, there was a significant concentration of the Hindus in West Kingston at the time. Now, the street meetings are very, very crucial to understand the early climate of Rastafari. Now, the street meetings in the ghettos of West Kingston and St. Thomas, they served as crucibles of Rastafari thought and practice. And so Howell was conducting these, but he wasn't the only one that was conducting these street meetings. During these street meetings or street preachings, the image of Selassie was commonly on display as part of the whole street preaching. And I have an image right in front of me looking at Selassie in an image on a street meeting during that time. Homiak actually describes these images as surrogates for the emperor. They were these kinds of deputized symbolic representations of the divine king. And moreover, in the 1960s famous Rastafari report, we know that Rastas were already making vows to Selassie's photograph. And now this is important as well, because this sort of praxis of and relationship to imagery is something that resonates with the use of imagery to focus on the divine in Hinduism. But that's just a kind of relationship that I want us to keep in mind as well as we continue. Now, after street meetings and all of that, we need to also think about the start of Pinnacle, the first Rastafari commune. And so in 1934, Howell was actually charged with sedition. And after his release and all of that, he formed the first Rastafari commune known as Pinnacle in St. Catherine. And it was most famous for its ganja cultivation. Now, when asked, Bill Howell, who is Leonard Howell's son, and he was born at Pinnacle, when he was asked who was the main consumers, who are the ones that were actually buying this ganja, he actually responded that it was Kapatula, this Indian fraternity, but he doesn't really give much details about it. And that was actually something that really fascinated me, because who the hell are these Kapatula people? You know, in Jamaica, you have at a time where there's this noticeable gap between the possibility of this radical freedom that was given to the inhabitants, but it was so much different from their actual lived experiences. And so I'm thinking especially about this organization called Kapatula. Who were they? And so the first thing I did was I tried to do some archival research to think about them. And this is some ongoing research that I'm actually doing right now. But I actually tried to locate them in just academic search engines and all of that. I couldn't find them. But we actually found Kapatula was in the Gleaners archive. And so the Kapatula first appears in the Gleaner in 1920. Where he was asking for a reduction of the water rates on Kingston Penlands. And it doesn't seem like much of a big deal. But what was interesting about this article is that it was positioned in the Gleaner, maybe more than likely unintentionally, or probably it was intentional, with this sort of advertisement for Bea Bea pills. And then you saw dangerous fakers, and you saw these Indian cartoony figures calling them fakers and all of that. But that was really interesting. But I wanted to know about this Kapatula fraternity. Who were they? But where I want to shift gear now to is to think about the start of Pinnacle, the first Rastafari commune. And so in 1934, Howell was actually charged for sedition. And upon release, he left St. Thomas and he formed the first Rastafari commune known as Pinnacle in St. Catherine. Pinnacle is usually famous for its ganja cultivation. And according to Leonard Howell's son, Bill Howell, ganja was the preferred name of the plant there. You know, when asked as well, who were the main buyers of ganja from Pinnacle, because that was always something that was interesting to me, because we know that a lot of money was coming from the cultivation of ganja, and there was a communal community, and we wouldn't expect them to be buying the ganja themselves. So who were the main buyers of ganja from Pinnacle? And Bill actually responded that it was Kapatula, an Indian fraternity, but he didn't give any details beyond this. And so I was really curious, you know, because what does it mean? What does that mean? An Indian fraternity? What does Kapatula mean? I've never encountered this before in my reading of Indo-Jamaican history. And so I was curious where Kapatula came from. And it sounded like a kind of organized gang based on just that small description that Bill gave. And that, for me, that was really interesting, because definitely in Jamaica, what was perceived, there's definitely a perceivable, noticeable gap between the possibility of the radical freedom that was given to its inhabitants versus their actual or their lived experience. And so I was curious about this Kapatula thing. And so I tried searching some archives. I tried doing some searches on some academic engines. I couldn't find anything, or databases, academic databases. I couldn't find anything on Kapatula. No, where I actually encountered Kapatula was in the Gleaner. In some of the cases that were presented in the Gleaner, the first date that Kapatula appears in the Jamaican Gleaner, based on my research, was in 1920. And so Kapatula was asking for a reduction of the water rates on Kingston Penlands. And I'm not sure if this was related to the Kapatula that Howell's son or Bill was mentioning. And that necessarily doesn't seem like a kind of problem to worry about. No, I continued searching, and the next time we found him was in 1921, and it was in a civil case. And it was a case called Alexander Simpson v. Capitula. And Capitula, in the newspaper, you actually see East Indians in brackets. And so that's interesting to me because Capitula right here, it possibly could have meant a group of East Indians, or maybe it was just one East Indian, or it was just an organization of East Indian that was named after its leader, Capitula. We don't know. But what happened in this case was that there were some items that were purchased, quote unquote, purchased on credit, and Simpson was seeking back his money, and Capitula basically declares that he doesn't owe anything, but it doesn't sound like a kind of organized crime that I'm interested in. Now, when we reach 1923 first, and then 1926, that's when I start seeing Capitula in criminal cases. And so the first one was an article called the Resident Magistrate's Court, Kingston, which is a recording of all the cases that were brought before the resident magistrates. And in this case, Capitula, East Indian, was charged with assaulting Francis Bailey. And then we meet Capitula again. This person actually had a first name in 1926, Altaman Capitula, and he was charged with larceny of jewelry on the property of Rebecca Chandler, his stepmother. Now, we continue reading because I was very determined to find out who this Capitula person was. And so we have criminal cases throughout the 1930s. And so we have an article titled Arrests Made in City. We have another one titled Revolver Shots Startled Spanish Town Road Residents. And it's Altaman Capitula again who was firing shots. There's also man is arrested on assault charge, and that was Charles Capitula of Spanish Town Road. And so that was interesting to me, but it doesn't necessarily build this idea of what Capitula was. It was just these one-off cases. And then we have criminal and civil cases coming up again in the later part of the 1930s. One of them was actually a civil case brought against Capitula. And the next one, he was actually a witness in a criminal case. And that's where the Gleaner archives end this Capitula recording. There's nothing else about Capitula that I could find. And so we're going to continue on this idea of Capitula because that's an important part of this presentation. And that's why I have Coolie Gang in its title. But we're going to go back to Pinnacle for a bit. And so we know that at Pinnacle, Howell was cultivating ganja. And one of the things that to prevent the sort of destruction of his ganja cultivation, he used to actually bribe a lot of politicians, bureaucrats, police. We know he bribed them with money. We know that he bribed them with curry goat. There's actually a story by Bill Howell he hates this person, this particular police very much, where he would have come with him big belly, sit down, and wait for a goat kill, and then curry him and all of that. And then there's one time as well when in there for pull him button, cut him ten and pull him button, he won't have curry goat in him, did it. So we know that Howell used to bribe politicians, bureaucrats, police, with money and curry goat, right? But we know that came to an end at some point. Now, in 1953, Winston Churchill decided to put an end to this ganja trade. Norman Manley, I believe, upon receiving that information, reaches out to Mortimer Plano, and this was said by Mortimer Plano. So he said that Norman Manley called him into his office and told him, "Morty, you must tell your half-Indian brother them to quit the ganja business." And this is very important as well because in case we don't know anything about black markets and black market economics and just economics in general, when we restrict supply, it doesn't necessarily reduce demand. And so that really creates a good possibility for a kind of black market. Now, Norman Manley, in confidence, the planner tells him that he needs to tell him half Indian brother them to quit the ganja business. Now, how big was this ganja business? It's hard to estimate. You have Lucky Gordon, who was a Jamaican-born London-based pimp, that was later a part of this whole perfumer scandal. That helped expose how huge the ganja trade was. And what was its relationship to Pinnacle, we may never know. But we can say that the sort of ganja trade that was happening
was a significant thing at the time, and I'm going to be talking more about that on Capatula soon. Now, what was the actual trade like? Now, when Rastas bought ganja from Pinnacle, they would buy it alongside yams, and they would cover the ganja with yams. Now, in the 1940s, ganja actually starts circulating in small standardized packages that kind of suggest an industrial production. East Indians were the main retailers. No questions, no ifs, no buts, no maybes. East Indians were definitely the main retailers of the small standardized packaged ganjas. And so they were buying the ganja from Pinnacle. Now, some of the remembered among these buyers were, their names were given as Kulibwai, Baiwadem, and Sital. And those big dealers who came, they were those big dealers who came to Pinnacle for major purchases of ganja. And so if Helen Lee labels them as a gang, no, she says their gang, the Capatula, controlled the Western ghettos and the Spanish Town Road traffic. And so what was interesting and important here was the sort of connection between Capatula and the early sort of dissemination plan of ganja in Jamaica in the organized crime setting. Now, in any sort of organized crime, there's going to be this code of secrecy that happens, but there are going to be also these bandolo variables that are very important to those who participate in it. And so, for example, if police was going to raid Pinnacle, we know that Kulibwai would inform Pinnacle because he would get information from those people, from whoever flew the helicopters, from whoever was coming up to Pinnacle. And so he acted as a kind of liaison between the community of cultivators and the sort of the officials. And so here's a story. When the government dispatched his helicopters to search out ganja fields, Goldburn told Kulibwai, who went up to Pinnacle to exchange the info for some high-degree bushweed, sometimes Kulibwai would also ask his pilot friend to delay a trip for a day or two until the crop was secure. And we know that this is something, this sort of practice is not unique to this kind of setup. We know that this happens in Jamaica with It possibly still happens in Jamaica with other things where there are raids on communities for many things, possibly utilities or anything like that. And you have an informant who tells the community and they prepare for that sort of raid to prevent any sort of criminal sanctions or anything like that. I never said so, so me ear, so me give what me get, me give. Now, Bogart from that time actually says Kulibwai became very rich because of this ganja trade. But then Norman Manley called Kulibwai specifically and asked him to quit. And the story goes that Kulibwai did eventually quit this ganja trade. Now, at that time as well, in the 1950s, guns began appearing in the ghettos in Jamaica. They were mainly bought from the police. In 1954, we have Elijah Powell, the chief ganja man at Pinnacle. He was arrested for the illegal possession of a firearm. And we know his weapon was bought from a policeman. There's little doubt in Jamaica that the 1950s saw the rise of the international ganja trade. And that was controlled by these sort of small figures, or not necessarily small, but these figures that I'm mentioning, but some unnamed figures for obvious reason, because we're dealing with a black market right here. And so when the political parties started, and this is what Helen Lee says, when Jamaican political parties started arming their ghettos around election time, the guns came mostly from ganja profits. Now, I don't know that. Possibly it is, possibly it wasn't, but that's what Helen Lee says. And she says the new gold of Jamaica, which was ganja, was fueling the system, putting the country in the hands of criminals. Now, I don't know. Maybe that's a fair conclusion. Maybe it isn't. I'm not really sure. And what's worse is that most of the trial records concerning Howell and Pinnacle, they were destroyed in the criminal arsenal of the Spanish Town Courthouse. And so we don't know what exactly happened. We can only use oral testimonies or gossip or mix up, as we say in Jamaica, and all of that. We have to use illegal historical sources to sort of recuperate this information. it's really hard. And because there's also a lot of officials in Jamaica who are implicated in this sort of scandal, we may never, ever be actually aware of how, what was the exact relationship between Capitola, Pinnacle, and the wider Jamaican political landscape. And in, what's interesting, here's a quote from the Star on August 24, 1954. It seems obvious that an export trade exists and it is highly organized. No doubt the planting is financed by a gang. Indeed, we could say a great deal more were it not for the laws of libel. And so it seemed maybe it was an open secret at the time, but maybe it has died with all the people who were necessarily familiar with it. Now let's get back to Pinnacle. Now, the Pinnacle, let's go back to Rastafari. Let's go back to the religiosity of the movement. Now, Pinnacle became the blueprint of the future Rastafari communal communities. At Pinnacle, Howell would emphasize being called by his Indian name, Ganga Gangur Maharaj, rather than his given birth name. And Jeffet, one of the early followers of the movement, actually recalls, when we say Mr. Howell, he would say, no, Ganga Gangur Maharaj, and everybody would say, yes, Gong. And Gong is really interesting right here, because that's actually where Bob, not a lot of people know that, but that's where Bob Marley gets this name from, the Gong. He gets it from Leonard Howell's Indian name, Ganga Gangur Maharaj. And another interesting point as well about this Indian name as well, the Howellites would inject Howell's Indian last name in their songs about Howell. And so they refer to him, for example, as their African Gangro, suggesting a kind of African Indian intimacy in his evocation. Now, another interesting point as well about in Pinnacle that's really important for this research is a prayer, a mystical prayer that they, or a chant that they used to say at Pinnacle. Now, a reporter who visited Pinnacle recalls listening to, and this is what I quote, a mysterious prayer on various occasions, yet was unable to give its interpretation, but was able to say that it forms a pivotal part of all Rastafarian ceremonies. You want to hear them up there, about Pinnacle, a chant. Now, this prayer featured a lot of Indian words, and we have scholars like Ajay and Lakshmi Mansingh who have deciphered some of these words, like Yedeko, which means like look here, or Mata, which means mother, or anything like that. So Rastas were, they ended up at Pinnacle, and you want to hear them a chant in an Indian language. They were obligated to recite this chant before bed. They also recited this chant in rituals outside of Pinnacle, like, for example, when they were tried. And the language of the chant we know was given to Howell by Lalo, again, my uncle's name, but also Howell's bodyguard, an Indo-Jamaican. And he was a personal bodyguard to Howell. In some scholarship, it might have been Lalo who actually introduced the concept of black supremacy to Howell. It might have also been Lalo who introduced a lot of the mysticisms to the movement. Now, we know from Bill Howell, that's Leonard Howell's son, that when Indians came to Pinnacle, they were welcomed and they were supposed to receive, according to Leonard Howell, special treatment or a special place at Pinnacle as visitors. Now, Pinnacle, we have to remember, wasn't this bed of roses. It wasn't free from periodic assault. We have to remember as well that there were many periodic assaults on the commune by the colonial government. Those in authority maintained a very close watch on Howell, and often they would police his activities. You know, in between raids, as mentioned earlier, he would extort and bribe those police, you know, killing and preparing curry goats, giving them money, buying this, buying that, doing all of that. There was one charge that was brought against him in one of the raids, or that was really interesting. For me, what was super interesting about that was they were using art as evidence against the Rastafari movement, or what they call the cult of Rastafari. And in these drawings, Petrine Archand, a Jamaican art historian, actually sees the resonances between those art pieces and the Indo-Jamaican Hosse celebration that I'd mentioned earlier. Jake Homiak actually thinks about the relationship between these two in a very anthropological setting that I won't necessarily get more into, but it's very interesting to note this kind of parallel between these two things. Okay. And to learn more about the relationship between the Indians and Pinnacle, you can read more about it in my paper that I'd mentioned earlier, and we'll link it on the Tenement Yard website. So there were many periodic assaults on the commune by the colonial government. We have to remember that those in authority were maintaining very, very, very close watch on Howell. His activities were often policed. In between raids, the police would extort Howell. As mentioned earlier, he would pay them money, or he would prepare food for them, curry goat specifically. Now, the raid that I want us to think about is after the 1954 raid. That's the most famous raid on the Pinnacle, and after the 1957 raid as well. Each of these raids ended with calculated destructive acts, and so the Howellites were scattered across Jamaica because their commune was destroyed. And this, some have said, was what really allowed Rastafari to help Rastafari ideas spread a lot. This sort of destruction of the Pinnacle and them scattering all over in Jamaica, that is something that's very important in how the ideas of Rastafari spread. Not the only important thing, but a very important thing. Now, the most substantive scattering of fugitives fled to the West Kingston ghettos on Indian settlement. And so Kingston Pen, in the environs of Spanish Town Road, it was bought by an 1885 indenturer, Tiwari, in the 1920s. It had five sections: Newland, Akiwak, Bakawal, Grassyard, and Marangaleen. Now, according to the Mansings, it became the center of Hinduism and Indian culture in Jamaica. Until the 1960s, actually, we know that Kingston Pen and Denham Town, and 4 miles as well, they were known as Hindu Town. And in West Kingston, Indian sessions, which were these celebrations of Indian heritage and Indian religiosities, they were alive in these spaces. These performances helped to reconstruct a distant Indian, interrupted Indian history, and helped reaffirm their Indian identity, their Indian religiosity. The Hinduism that was alive and kicking. And it was kicking because of the kind of ravaging Christian force that was present in Jamaica. Now, Rastas left Pinnacle, fled from Pinnacle. They chose Indian lands in West Kingston systematically while fleeing state persecution. You know, Rastas were pouring into places like Akiwak and Bakawal in as early as the 1941 raid on Pinnacle. And so it wasn't as if they didn't know about these spaces. The sort of engagement that happened between the Indians and Rastas, it wasn't, for me, it's no surprise that they were pouring into these places. Now, another group in these of Rastas in these environs is the Igelic House. And the Igelic House of Rasta, or the Igelites, they lived in Warrica Hills. They frequently traveled on the axis between Bakawal and Warrica Hills. Now, the Igelites are very, very, very important to understand this I and I concept that I'll get into. But the Igelites are very much, their practice intersects in 503 ways with the sadhus of West that I had mentioned earlier. And so we know that, for example, they had several austere practices, you know, their minimal clothing, vegetarian lifestyle. Because remember, the Rastas at Pinnacle, they weren't vegetarians, you know, they were the dreadlocks and all of that. They didn't have those. You have the stories of the monk, the Pinnacle Lions and all that, but majority of Rastas there, they didn't have the locks and all of that. What I want us to get right here, and all I've spoken about, is these sort of encounters and interactions. At this point, we know that throughout the life of early Rastafari, there were many entry points that Indians, and specifically Hinduism, could have entered into. Now, I'm focusing, my research focused heavily on I&I, the I&I concept. And I want to show how specifically the I and I concept resonates strongly with these sort of Hindu spiritualities that were brought to Jamaica. So again, more background information on Rastafari. Again, background information on Rastafari was given, background information on the Indians were given. And so now we reached the major part of my research, the I and I concept. Now, Jamaicans hear I and I, most of them don't take it seriously. They don't necessarily understand. They think it's a, they don't necessarily contemplate what does I and I mean. And so I and I is a core fundamental concept in Rastafari, in both the language and practice of the movement. Now, it's a combination, obviously, of the words I and I. And it's combined like that to reflect the related universalizing, metaphysical, and linguistic features of Rastafari. And so in terms of linguistics, I and I can be the subject or object pronoun for every person. So there's no you, we, us, they, the, everything is I and I, right? That's done because Rastas emphasize the every human being as a kind of perpetual subject, meaning you cannot be an object ever. You can't, there's nothing else. There's just the I. So there's I and I. Now, this is done also to reflect the way in which Rastafari thinks about its metaphysics. Now, when Rastas say I and I, they're doing that to sort of emphasize the relationship between people. And so when to speak to another is to speak to the self. Now, it's almost as if there's this reflective, to speak to another is this kind of reflective process in the Rastafari metaphysics. And so to say I and I or to chant I and I is to highlight that relationship. Now, another important part of that as well is to realize that Rastas collapse the distinction between God and people. And so for Rastas, all humans possess this divine essence about them. And so there is no God beyond. There is I and I. And so that's the Rasta I. So it's a conversation. I and I, and it sounds simple, but it's a conversation about Rastafari ontology, Rastafari metaphysics overall, and Rastafari's understanding of the English language. Now, an important consideration in I and I metaphysics is questioning how I and I move from the more limited self-awareness to realize the greater I and I. Right. And so Rastas do this, or Rastas' approach to this is through what I've come to call the web of I and I, which is an esoteric web or an esoteric nexus of ideas and practices that detail the different paths to I and I realization. Now, I've in my paper that I'd mentioned earlier, I detail the teachings under five categories: the knowledge of the eyes, the jacking, entheogenesis, reasoning, and ever living, while showing or crystallizing the relationship to Hindu spiritualities, talking about the encounters and talking about how it's important to read these in conversation with Hinduism. Now, one of the key considerations as well that I was looking at in my research was the questioning of when does this I and I language emerge? If you read the Promised Key, which is the first Rastafari text that was produced within the movement, it doesn't use I and I language like that. You know, I and I language is not part of it, even though it was published in 1934, 1935, thereabout. It was written and published around that time. There's some care, however, or concern for language in the Promised Key. In it, we have Leonard Howell, or more rightly, Ganga Ganguru Maharaj, stating there was one perfect language on the face of the globe, you know, hinting at corrupted tongues purposed by and for the powerful. But that doesn't necessarily answer this sort of I and I language. You know, now the next thing that we need to think about is what is Rastafari language? Because I and I language is just part of that. And so a key question that I've had throughout this research was, when does the I and I language emerge? And when does I and I metaphysics emerge as well? Now, I described the metaphysics a bit earlier, but specifically, when does the language itself emerge? Now, let's dress back a little and think about what is Rastafari language. And so Velma Pollard describes the Rastafari language known as Dread Talk, I Talk, or Iaric, as an adjustment of the lexicon of Jamaican Creole to reflect the religious political and philosophical positions of the believers. And in a recent lecture by Dr. Antoinette Stein, she described the Rastafari language as creatively cryptic. Now, Pollard categorizes the vocabulary in Ayaric into three categories. The first one was items bearing new meanings. The second one was the words that bear the weight of their phonological implications. And the third one was the I words. And the I words is what I'm super interested in. Now, in the Promised Key, we see that there's no I and I language, but there's some concern at least or care for language in the Promised Key. For example, we know that in the Promised Key, Gangun Maharaj says there was one perfect language on the face of the globe, you know, hinting at the way in which the languages that now operate or corrupted tongues that now operate are purposed by and for the powerful. Now, Chevans actually suggests that it was the youth Black faith who came about in the 1940s that's where he traces the origin of Ayaric to the youth Black faith in the 1940s. But Pollard actually dismisses this. She says that this could only supply the second category of words. That's the words that only bear the phonological implications, the way in which, like we said, downpress instead of oppress or stuff like that. Like she's saying, well, probably that's them, but she doesn't see how it's necessary or is useful for the first category of words that she described, or the I language. And the I language is what I am interested in. Now, Homiak actually dates the emergence of the I words to the 1950s using oral testimonies, chants, and available information on the Igelic house or the Igelites. And he says that the Igelites diffused the I words when they assimilated into the wider network or the island-wide network of Rastas. Now, by the 1955, we have a carved piece or a sculpt. We have a David Miller sculpting a piece called Rasta Don't Touch I. But the question about that is, was it named in 1955 or was it named sometime after when it became a famous art piece? You know, but by the 1960s, we know for a fact that the I language was part of the Rastafari movement. And so Sheila Kitzinger, doing fieldwork in Jamaica, pays attention to the I language. And she notes that as a general rule, Rastas refer to themselves always in the nominative case, here I when I call. And so that kind of helps us to answer when it emerges. One, we know it emerges by the 1960s, possibly in the 1950s, based on what Homiak says. But before that, we really don't have any clue. Now, to get back to this concept of I and I, because the I and I concept, the metaphysical relationship that I'm interested in, the web of I and I that I'm interested in, that's what the bulk of my research was about. And this was where I could draw the kind of parallels, but also the interreligious encounters that were important in understanding or reading the Rastafari movement or metaphysics in conversation with Hinduism. Now, I'll only go over three here, which is the Jacking, Reasoning, and Entheogenesis. But you can read the rest in my paper that I had mentioned earlier. Now, the first one is the Jacking. Now, as mentioned earlier, Rastafari starts a reaction to the crowning of His Imperial Majesty in 1930. His Imperial Majesty was an articulation out of the white world. Howell declares him in no uncertain terms as divine. So he says in the Promised Key, His Majesty Rastafari is the head over all man, for he is the supreme God. His body is the fullness of him that fills all in all. His Majesty Rastafari, the living creator, the living God, and earth superior, the master builder of creation, the perfect royal head of this world. Now, in what way is this related to Hinduism? How we're going to get that relationship is that we have to go back to the people who are actually declaring His Imperial Majesty first as divine, as the Jacking. And so the four founders that I've mentioned were Hibbert, Howell, Hines, and Dunkley. Now, we leave Dunkley off for a bit because Dunkley, we know that he was reading the Bible to find Rastafari as divine. So he already had the idea that Rastafari was divine, but he was reading into the Bible to corroborate this idea of him being divine. Now, so we're going to focus on the three H's, Hibbert, Howell, and Hines. Now, in an interview with the Mansings, Joseph Nathaniel Hibbert tells them that In 1921, I acquired books to know about Hindu gods, Rama, Krishna, Buddha, Ashoka, and became convinced that Africa also has such a god, except that we do not know of him. Now, this idea, this sentence really resonates with what in Hinduism is known as Bhakti Yoga. Now, in Hinduism, there are three paths to Brahman. There's Bhakti Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Karma Yoga. And so the two important ones here are the Bhakti Yoga and Gyan Yoga. Now, Joseph Hibbert tells them that in 1921, I acquired books to know about the Hindu gods, Rama, Krishna, Buddha, Ashoka, and became convinced that Africa also has such a god, except that we do not know of him. And this for me was very important. One, because it resonated with the idea of Bhakti in Hinduism. And two, we see the clear Hindu influence right here. Now, he doesn't know of Selassie in this sentence, but he's definitely looking for that African equivalent of these Hindu gods. Now, if you don't know what the three paths of Brahman are in Hinduism, they are Bhakti Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Karma Yoga. Now, Bhakti Yoga is very, very much resonates with this idea, as I said earlier, that Hibbert hints at. And so, Bhakti Yoga is a devotion to a specific Ishtadeva. Now, this, in Hinduism, this may be Lord Vishnu. It may be one of his popular avatars, such as Ram, Krishna. It could be whoever the Bhakti devotee decides it to be. Now, the Ishtadeva becomes Brahman, or the supreme, or the ultimate reality itself. And that the Ishtadeva is the part or articulation of that path to Brahman. What was important to recognize here was that by this time, even before the coronation of His Imperial Majesty, Hibbert was looking for an African equivalent of a Hindu Ishtadeva. So this right here is really important, because even way before the coronation of His Imperial Majesty, we know that one of the first leaders of the Rastafari movement, one of the first to chant Rastafari as divine, was looking for this African equivalent, and it was definitely influenced by this sort of Hindu input. Okay, so that was Hibbert. Now, to get to the others, I'm going to read a section of my paper right now, and bear with me if it sounds a bit boring, but I think it's really interesting and important that we get this done. So, building on the above in Rastafari, as a development of the teaching that each and every person is divine and of the same nature as Jah, it is acknowledged that at certain points in human history, various figures have appeared who manifest their divinity in a greater than normal fashion. And so in this current age, that would be Selassie. Selassie is thought to be in a line of succession of Jesus. Sometimes he's referred to as Yahshua, to emphasize that Jah. But Jesus is also in that line of succession, because for some Rastas, Elijah was before Jesus. And this is this really was really interesting and important, because it echoes a lot of the idea of the avatars in the books that I'd mentioned, the religious books that I'd mentioned that the Hindus were using in Jamaica, the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, and the Bhagavatam Puran. Another important thing as well is Howell's Indian name, Ganga Gangur Maharaj. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are three paths to Brahman. There's Bhakti Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Karma Yoga. Now, Howell's Indian name actually had that second path in it, the Gyan Yoga. Now, let me just read another section of my paper as well. So Howell, who influenced Heine's understanding of the Jah King, also had explicit Hindu influence in the realization of Selassie divine. Rastafari elder Fillmore Alvaranga, describing Howell's understanding of the Jah King, explains that when Howell come here, he come and wake us up to those things. And when he told us about Rastafari and we check history, we see he is the returned Messiah. You know, such a claim might allow one to speculate on the possibility that Howell was not a reading of the Bible that allowed Howell to conclude that Selassie was divine, but instead it was the followers who later validated the emperor through revisiting familiar scriptures. Another important thing as well to recognize is that Howell's Indian first name, Ganganguru, consisted of the word Gyan, another path outlined in the Gita as the path of knowledge or self-realization. This path deals with the Atman and Brahman and their relationship. Usually one who pursues this path is aided by a guru, which could have been Lalu for Howell. In the Gita, Krishna tells Arjun Following this path and having achieved enlightenment from a guru or Arjuna, you will no longer fall into delusion. In the light of that knowledge, you will see that all living beings are but parts of the Supreme and are within me. Similarly, the realization of I and I draws on an understanding that there is an interconnected divine within all, and even how Howell represented himself as divine at pinnacle after acquiring knowledge about self resonates strongly with Krishna's teaching in the Gita. And so for me, that's enough to conclude about the conclude the relationship between the Jack King in Rastafari to Hinduism. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Hibbert, Howell, Hines. Hines was influenced by Howell. Hibbert was looking for an African equivalent to a Rama, Krishna, Buddha, Ashoka. And we know that Howell borrows his the Gyan Yog, the Gyan Yog language into his name. We also know that he sets up, his life is set up in a way with Lalu that resonates with Krishna's teaching in the Bhagavad Gita. So another idea that I want to get into in this whole web of I and I that I described earlier is this idea of reasoning in Rastafari. But before I get there, I want to go back a little and talk a bit more, remind us about the Kali Puja. Remember, the Kali Puja is the invocation of the goddess Kali or Mother Kali or Kalimai. And in this puja, in the ritualistic performance of the puja, a goat is sacrificed. Its blood is poured on a Kalimurti. The meat is used to prepare curry goat. The skin is used, is dried and used to prepare the dolak drums. And after the feasting, or while the meat is being prepared sometimes, ganja is smoked and bhang drinks or beverages are made from ganja. Now, I'm going to go get back into this when I talk more about entheogenesis and as well reasoning, but it's important to keep the Kali Puja in mind because Kali is very important to the Jamaican spiritual economy, not just in Rastafari, but we see Kali appearing in the revivalism. We also see Kali appearing in the general spiritual economy of Jamaica. We think about the Kuli Dopi, you know. Kali is the Kuli Dopi and Kali walk hand in hand, and Professor Hutton has mentioned the kind of relationship in one of his chapters in a book on early Rastafari. But to talk now more about the reasoning session specifically. Now, reasoning sessions in Rastafari are based on the idea that all possess an essence of the divine in them. And by interacting in conversation with each other, we can tease out some kind of truth. Usually this conversation happens after one is pivoted by ganja, which is the entheogen, which I'll get more into afterwards. Now, these communal sessions are very, very, very important to Rastafari because it's in these sessions that ideas are fleshed out, theocratic reasoning is done, politics is done. But it also is very important because it helps to reconstruct and reconnect to a kind of ancestral reality, not in a sort of performance way per se, but in a kind of the connection to this kind of ancestral genealogy is done through the kind of conversations that you're having. Now, it's believed by some scholars that it's within these sessions that the I language, Iaric or I talk, this is where it emerges, or not necessarily emerges, but spreads. It's because of these sessions, because of these conversations that they continue to have within these kinds of reasoning sessions. That's what allows for Iaric and Italk to really spread throughout the Rastafari community. Now, interestingly, I'd mentioned earlier about the sadhus who came to Jamaica and the sort of sadhus, the way in which they showed up in Jamaica's history at the time of Rastafari, before Rastafari and the period after the start of Rastafari. And one of the most interesting practices of the sadhus are some sessions, some smoking sessions, in which they would use the ganja to meditate, to focus on divine bliss, and to connect to the divine. And so the Ajahn Lakshmi Man Singh have written a paper which they said that the sadhus smoke ganja in praises to divine in order to seek release from the mortal coils. And this isn't something that was only done during this time. This is something that's still practiced today in India. In modern day India, this way of performing ganja smoking or ganja ritual is still done with the sadhu practice in India. Now, Rasta reasoning sessions begin usually with the ganja being lit in the kochi or chilium. And the Kochi Orchilam is dedicated to the emperor. Today, it would be called the chalice. It's dedicated to the emperor. Now, similarly, in the Kali Puja that I had mentioned earlier and some of the tantric sessions that I'd also mentioned earlier, the Ganges is dedicated to the mother goddess before smoking. And so before smoking, they would shout Jai Kali Mai. And sometimes a mantra would precede the hailing of the goddess. Jai can mean hail, as in hail Mother Kali. It can be used to mean victory to or glory to. So for example, in the Ramayana, we can think about when Lord Ram is going into battle with Ravan, and you can think about when they say Jai Ramji, which is victory to Lord Ram or glory to Lord Rama. In the same way in Rastafari, when we think about the ritual performance of the reasoning sessions, you have the Kochi or the chalice or the chilam being lit and dedicated to the emperor in a very similar way, in a very almost mirroring way, shouting Jai Rastafari. And I've matched up the sort of pronunciation of Jai and Jai using the IPA system I've matched up the pronunciation of Jai and Jai in a way to show how the sounds are related. But we can also think about how semantically the way of praising Jai Rastafari is done similarly to how it's being done in the production of Hindu spirituality. And so in Rastafari, Jai Rastafari can mean glory to Rastafari, victory to Rastafari when he's resisting colonial powers, or even Hail Rastafari, which is a very, very, very common way of using Jai Rastafari. That's how it's used. It's understood as a kind of Hail Rastafari. Now, similarly as well in the Hindu performance of Jai Kali Mai, that can be done in a way where it can be done at a time of despair, at a time where you need that sort of divine or out there kind of comfort, a way in which of inviting that kind of presence into that time of difficulty. And similarly, we know that Pinnacle, residents of Pinnacle, some of the Howellites, when they were being tried in these songs of comfort, these resistance songs, this kind of Jai Rastafari is being pronounced and performed in a very similar way to what was happening in the Hindu performance of the Jai Kali Mai. Now, beyond that as well, reasoning sessions usually happen within this yard, a herbs yard. But Shevans has told us that this idea of a herbs yard was not new in Jamaica. It doesn't come with Rastafari. He even makes mention of an anecdote with a World War One, an Indian during the time of the World War One, operating a herbs yard, as we call it. And further beyond that as well, herbs yard are used for these medical purposes. And we know that Ayurveda, which is the kind of holistic medicine that was brought to Jamaica by the Indians, and we have stories of them on the Kalapani, on the ships to Jamaica, practicing these kinds of medicines, we know that this was happening in Jamaica. So the idea of a herbs yard and the idea of a yard or a space dedicated using these specific medicines such as ganja doesn't seem like a new idea in Jamaica. And we know that Rastas were very much adjacent to these ideas and these performances. And so that's something that we have to keep in mind when we think about the reasoning sessions and all of that. Now, the last point that I'll talk about in this episode in terms of the web of INI is this idea of entheogenesis. And many of us may not necessarily know what entheogenesis is, or we've never probably heard of it. So I'll just go over a definition and then get more into it. So entheogenesis is basically the ritual ingestion of a spiritual technology. And so we know in Rastafari, the commonly used entheogenesis ganja. Now we have to take this very seriously, because why is it that ganja is being used in Rastafari? Why is it an entheogen in the first place? And is there any sort of historical precedence of that really happening in Jamaica? And of course, as I said earlier, there was the Kali Puja, but also just the Sadhu tantric sessions that I've mentioned earlier. Now, beyond these kinds of ritualistic performances, we know that ganja was introduced to Jamaica as an entheogen by Indian indentures. But beyond that, the kind of language and physics surrounding the apparatus used in entheogenesis in Rastafari comes from Indians. And so, for example, we can appreciate the linguistic borrowings of Rastas from Hindi to describe the sacred plant and its accompanying apparatus. And so, for example, the plant is often referred to as ganja or kali weed,
this definitely comes from the Indian languages, and it is, there's no question about that, ganja and kali. But also as well, we know that chilom comes from chiliam, and kochi and sapi comes from Indian languages. But even we have to remember as well, sometimes we don't refer to these things as that anymore. And we know that by a certain turn of the century, we know that Rastas started using Christian framework to validate their uses of many things. And so the kochi and the chilam became the chalice. We know ganja, a lot of them start referring to it as the holy herb, and a lot of scholarship and a lot of scholars in the academy as well are guilty of this because they've sort of forced a way of understanding Rastafari to Rastafari adherents and the Jamaica at large. And so, for example, you'll hear some Rastas refer to ganja now as the holy herb, or they won't use any kind of Hindi references to the plant itself to sort of wipe away that sort of Indian part of its genealogy. Now, outside of that as well, we can also appreciate the buildup of the physics of the apparatus that they use in these kind of entheogenic performances. And so we know that the smoking receptacles, which we know are from India, the ones that are named in Indian language, the ones that aren't named using Indian languages, we know that the physics of those function like the physics of that which was being used by the Indians. And so, for example, we have the chalice as well being used or being built just like the hookah that Indian women would use in Jamaica. So I leave it there. If you're interested in the rest of these sort of parallels and fleshing out more of these ideas that I'd spoken about, but also the death and the Atman Brahman and the different parts of knowledges of I and all of that, you can read my paper. But I want to go to sort of the concluding part of my paper and some of the ideas that I wanted to really get out there. One of the things that I wanted to think about was, when does this I and I concept emerge, right? And so, as I said, Leonard Howell, in his book, which was penned under the name Ganga Ganguru Maharaj, he didn't write in this sort of I language, Iaric way. We have the sort of linguistic tracing that I'd mentioned earlier, the one we talk about, Chevans in the Youth Black Faith and the Igelic House, and then Sheila Kitzinger notes this by the 1960s, we have this clear relationship to I. But for me, the concept is also important. It's also important to think about the concept of I and I emerging. Does it emerge before or at the same time as the language of I and I? And for me, it seems much more clear that the concept emerges, the concept of I and I emerges before this. And my evidence is that first things first is the idea of the Jack King or the Divine King. We know that Selassie, being the Jack King, being the divine manifestation, the greater than normal manifestation, that's a flashpoint to say I and I was present, but not necessarily the language. Another thing as well is the cultivation of ganja at Pinnacle for entheogenic purposes. And we know that ganja was being used for that sort of entheogenic trot or that entheogenic travel within the reasoning sessions, or even just in personal use. But also remember that Howell viewed his own divinity at Pinnacle as well. So we know that understanding of the divine self was at Pinnacle. And so we know that the I and I concept was present. And so we can conclude safely, in my opinion, that the I and I concept definitely emerges before this I and I linguistics or I and I language. These clues would definitely suggest that the I and I concept can be traced back to the genesis of the Rastafari movement, and it continued to develop throughout its infancy. And so thus the metaphysics of I and I emerges before the language of I and I. Now, beyond this as well, I'm also talking about Indo-Jamaican history and Indo-Jamaican heritage. And so one of the things that I grappled with as an Indo-Jamaican while doing this research is that Indo-Jamaican history is often presented as a kind of footnote or a forgotten chapter in Jamaican history overall, despite many things in our culture sort of having been contributed to Jamaica by Indians and by Indian culture. And some this work especially is done to sort of lift up that kind of way of viewing Jamaican history, not necessarily to overshadow Jamaican history in Indianness, but to think about the Indian contribution to Jamaican history. And I especially want to think about the historical silencing of the Indian in Rastafari metaphysics, which is why I brought about this understanding of I and I and all of that. Now,
Another thing as well, I want to read a section from my paper, because every time you talk about, you critique blackness or African traditions or African genealogy, you get accused of 5,000,003 things that are against the ideals of these movements. And so I want to read a section to sort of wipe out that relationship to the work that I had done. And so this article does not make the claim that Rastafari is any less black by shedding light on Hindu inputs in the movement. Such a tempting reading would mean that Rastafari becomes less black when one recognizes its white Christian elements. I believe scholars' disdain toward the Hindu contribution to Rastafari stems from the idea that the Indo-Jamaican community was and still is read as Indian and not as Jamaican. Moreover, far too many scholars have read Rastafari exclusively through Afrocentric lens. Afrocentric scholars have been determined to show that Rastafari is an African continuity rather than the movement center in Africa. Such short-sighted work assumes that for a culture to be considered authentically African or Black, it needs to be a part of a continuous transmission with little to no interruptions or influence from foreign cultures. Rastafari does not need to center an African system to center Africa. And interestingly, Shevans notes this or highlights this, this sort of un-African origin of the movement. He says, in its belief and ritual structures, Rastafari mutes its African religious pedigree. The single exception would be its own drumming tradition, whose evolution was influenced by both Buru and Kumina. This presents us with a paradox. The most vocally Pan-African religion in Jamaica is the least African in appearance, while visibly the most African are vocally the least Pan-African. So the way that I ended the paper was asking a question. How different would the theology of I and I be if Indian indentures did not come to Jamaica? And so that's a question that the audience and the listeners can grapple with. And so I'll end here by going back to where we started, to go about talk about indentureship in a few, and I'm going to end with the song that's going to take us out. But I just want to give you the English equivalent of what's being sung. So the song is called Jamaica Pardes Chale. It's sung by Beverly Pancham Ramprasad, and it was composed by Ramlal. And the song goes, Ram's children of the earth, the story of your parents is being related, of how they went to heaven, you left your family in the motherland to go to the foreign land of Jamaica. In the villages, they heard rumors that money grows on trees there. In order to go to the foreign land of Jamaica, good and bad all gathered on the ship, some changing names and addresses, all headed for the promised land. On finishing a contract in 5 years, they all intermixed, refusing caste. They came to work and live, calling Jamaica their own. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Lest We Forget, Tenement Yard's historical podcast. If you're interested in reading the paper that I'd written, Early Encounters in Jamaica, Hindu and Rastafari Divine Metaphysics, you can find that paper at the Journal of Interreligious Studies website. It's open access, so you can definitely get it, download it, and read it at your leisure. You can also follow me on Twitter if you're interested in the ongoing work that I'm doing. My handle is CoolieDuppy. You can also find all the sources that I used to inform this episode at Tenement Yard Media's website, or you can also follow them on Twitter as well, Tenement Yard Media. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. Make a fire.